This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. It's rare that a film so provokes the Vatican that it actively condemns it, but that's what happened with the new film, The Magdalene Sisters. The movie is about a shameful chapter in the not-so-distant history of the Irish Church, when so-called wayward girls were confined in asylums named after Mary Magdalene to do penance for their sins. Once there, they were forced to work without pay in convent laundries. The film focuses on three girls. One is a rape victim, one an unwed mother, and one is simply deemed too attractive and too flirtatious. The movie won the Golden Lion for Best Film at last year's Venice Film Festival. My guest Peter Mullen wrote and directed The Magdalene Sisters. Mullen is best known as an actor. He won acclaim for his starring role in Ken Loach's movie My Name is Joe. His other credits include Trainspotting, Shallow Grave, Braveheart, and Ordinary Decent Criminals. I asked him to describe the daily regimen in a Magdalene asylum.
Daily routine would be up around 6, 6.30, then it would be prayers, breakfast, and they'd be working by about 8. And they would finish around anywhere between 6:30 and 8:30 in the evening, depending on how much work there was to be done. They would normally launder. Oh, they would service hospitals, prisons, restaurants, as well as the whole domestic market, for want of a better word. And after work would finish, it would be prayers. If they were lucky, some edible dinner, and then bed, and then the same routine 7 days a week.
One of the many disturbing things in your film is that the girls aren't allowed to talk while they're working. What were they supposed to be doing, praying?
It depends. It sort of changes from Magdalene to Magdalene. The one that I decided to use in the film was based mainly between Galway and Cork, where no conversations were allowed between the girls. I'm told in other Magdalenes they had to say prayers all day long, or prayers were said to which they had to join in. But in this particular, if you like, the one that I chose for the film, there was to be no conversations between the girls, primarily because friendships of any description were not allowed. They were actively discouraged.
So friendship would be a diversion or a distraction or just simply too much comfort?
It's tough. It's hard to know, actually, really where that particular philosophy came from, whether it was just a means of keeping the work efficient or whether it was, as you suggest, something more punitive. That conversation in any personal relationships were to be discouraged as part of the penitence. It's hard to tell, actually, because it's the ones who are best informed as regards that are the Sisters of Mercy and the Sisters of the Good Shepherd who actually ran these organisations.
And they didn't talk?
They've spoke out a couple of times. They tend to suggest that society was to blame. And there's a thing going on just now where the church blames the state now blames the church. The truth is, at that time, the church was the state. For them now to suggest there was some kind of secular differential is absurd, because basically it was a theocracy at that time.
Well, what did you base your film on then? What research did you do, or what reliable information did you have, since so many of the girls who were Magdalenes, it sounds as if they were probably too ashamed to talk about their experience, if they survived, if they got out?
Yeah, still a large number of women are too ashamed to come forward and speak. Initially, I wrote the script from video testimony that I saw in the documentary Sex in a Cold Climate, which introduced me to the whole subject. So I wanted to write something first, so it was a personal reaction to what happened to these women. And then I wanted to show it to survivors. So I wrote the script first and showed it to two survivors. One was a former nun in a Magdalene asylum, and one was a survivor. And I asked them to read the script, and if they felt it was true, then I would go ahead, and if they felt it wasn't, then I wouldn't go ahead. And I made them that promise, and they read the script, and they came back, and they said, yes, it was true. So it was after that then, it was over a year before I could raise the money for the film, that I met several survivors, and also asked them to read the script and tell me if they felt it was authentic. And the thing you notice about a lot of the survivors is just how damaged they still are. They can't move forward. They can't quite get it out of their heads what happened to them. And that's very tragic, especially when you consider what they've been through. One or two, Mary Norris in Cork especially, has been a wonderful kind of spokesperson for the Magdalen survivors. And she's managed to move forward. But it's taken a lot of... It takes its toll. It's very, very difficult when you've been the victim of that kind of injustice to move on and for it not to dominate the rest of your life.
Well, the depiction of the nuns in the Magdalen asylums is particularly brutal. In your film, Sister Bridget is the head of the asylum, and she, among other things, revels in the money that the laundering operation brings in. The first we see of her in your film are her fingers. She's wearing a bank teller's rubber thimble for counting bills, which is what she's doing. Let's listen to a clip of that scene. Here, Sister Bridget is meeting the three girls whose stories the film tracks, Margaret, Bernadette, and Rose, for the first time, and she's laying down the rules of the house. Sister Bridget is played by Geraldine McEwen.
Breakfast is at 6. Prayer is at 6:30. Work begins at 7. Lunch is at...
Excuse me, sister. I think I should go. You see, my father was very upset.
Don't ever interrupt me, girl. Did no one ever tell you that it's bad manners to interrupt, or were you too busy whoring it with the boys to listen? Is that what it was?
No, sister.
And are you simple-minded? Is that what it is? Are you a simpleton? I decide when or if you're allowed to leave, and I think I can safely say it could be quite some time. What's your name?
Margaret, sister.
Margaret what?
Maguire.
Yours?
Rose Dunn.
We have a Rose. What's your middle name?
I don't have one, sister.
Well, perhaps not on your birth certificate, but I'm sure your parents will have thought of one or two names for you now. What's your confirmation name?
Patricia.
Then you may call yourself Patricia. Thank you, sister.
Thank you, sister.
And you?
Bernadette Harvey.
From St. Attractus?
Yes, sister.
Now, how would I know that?
Don't know, sister.
Is it that Principal McLaughlin is a very good friend of mine and has told me all about you? Or is it that after many years in charge of this convent, I know a little temptress when I see one?
I don't know, sister.
Well, blessed Mary, two simpletons in one day. Well, I'm sure we shall find out in the course of time, won't we?
One of the most disturbing things about this scene is that gentle voice combined with the... with the vicious sarcasm and something you can't see on the radio, the little smile that plays around Geraldine McEwen's mouth the whole time. How much direction did you give McEwen in this scene?
The only thing that I asked Geraldine to do was to smile as much as she could in the course of the whole film. Sister Bridget is based pretty firmly upon a nun that I worked for when I was 17 in London. And she was without doubt one of the strangest and cruelest people that I'd ever met in my life. And she knew how to hurt women in a way that I was too young really to know exactly what she was doing. But always she was smiling. And that was the only thing I said to Geraldine, was to keep smiling, because within that smile lay the real essence of Sister Bridget. And I think what it is about Sister Bridget, especially in Geraldine's portrayal, that I love so much, is you do get a sense of someone who has no doubt about what they do. It's not that she's a trained sadist or it's just that's how it manifests itself, because she has absolutely no doubts about that she's doing the right thing, including making money for the church, because they did, because the Magdalen laundries made extraordinary amounts of money in the 1960s and the early 1970s. And in fact, proof of that is when they ceased to make money is when the church began to wind them down. There was no great spiritual enlightenment, unfortunately, within the church. It was these suddenly became economic loss makers, as it were. They weren't, by their being, by the, them ceasing to be profitable, was the primary means for which to wind them down.
Once a girl landed in the asylum, how did she get out?
There was only three ways I reckon you could get out. One would be the obvious one, which is to escape, to kick down doors and climb walls. Another would be any male member of your family, and sometimes female member of your family, could come and get you out if they persevered and if they had the courage to challenge the authority of the church, which, given the context, the time was unusual, to say the least. People generally didn't challenge the authority of the church because they can effectively controlled, well, they believed they controlled their immortal souls, so they weren't about to challenge them. And the third way to get out would be at the behest of the Mother Superior. She had the sole discretion as to whether you could or could not leave.
Did the family always know where the girls were?
No. A lot of families, particularly brothers and sisters and cousins and stuff, extended family. No, oftentimes the girls would simply be taken away, and because many of them had their names changed, if a family did try and find them, then no girl of that name technically was actually there. There's an example of one man tells his story of how it took him 9 years to find his sister, and they kept saying that she wasn't there, and so he would look elsewhere and keep returning to the same place, which, as it transpired, was only 3 miles from where he actually lived. And it took him 9 years to finally say to the nuns, if I really do suspect my sister is there, and if you don't verify that so that I can come and get her out of there, then I'm going to take legal action. And finally the nuns relinquished and gave him and said that his sister was there, but they obviously, as I say, they changed her name. And when he finally got her, she was not in a good state. She'd become very ill, mentally and physically. But it's a classic example of it took a man 9 years before he would even consider legal action. And I think that's one of the hardest things for us to understand. It's like, why on earth would it take you that length of time before you would consider, you know, getting a lawyer onto it? And again, the truth of the matter is, no law created by man is of any use to you whatsoever when it comes to the church, because they have your immortal soul, quite simply. They decide whether you're going to go to heaven or you're going to go to hell.
I think one of the most depressing scenes in the movie, a girl finds a door open in the garden of the Magdalene, and she sneaks through it into the lane outside. She's free. After people have tried to get out, they've been caught. It's been years she's been in prison, and all she's thought about is getting out. And once she's out, gets scared and goes back in, as if she were imprisoned as much by her own mind and also by the culture beyond the gates of the asylum as she is by the walls and the doors.
That is one of the most tragic features about it, is that the girls effectively became their own captors. It's an incredibly efficient prison that doesn't need a great deal of prison guards, and it doesn't need barbed wire, and it doesn't need shark-infested waters. All it needs is for someone to put the fear of God into the prisoners, if you like, for them, even when the door is open, to not actually step out of it. And that's one of the most intriguing parts of that regime, from a writer and director's point of view, was that here was a prison that was not technically difficult to get out of. I mean, it wasn't easy, but it wasn't impossible by any means. There's a terrible example of five women who escaped from the asylum in Galway, and they escaped by putting their washing baskets up against a wall and using them as kind of step ladders. So again, it sort of demonstrates that it wasn't technically that difficult to get out of these places. Within a day, four of them had come back. Only one had stayed outside because there was simply nothing there for them. You know, they had no family by that time, and they had there was no prospects of work, and they had become, unbeknownst to themselves, institutionalized. And when you're institutionalized in that sense, then 'tis better the devil you know than the devil you don't.
Now, when I first heard about the Magdalene laundries, I assumed that the last ones closed sometime in the 60s or the 70s. They actually, the last one shut down in 1996. How? Why? Why do you think they lasted so long? And what did them away in the end? Was it the technology made the laundries obsolete, or was it an investigation?
Unfortunately, it was no investigation. It was technology and economics. By the early 1980s, from what we can gather, they'd ceased to make money. So the church, I'm almost positive the church would have shut them down at that time. They would have shut them down in the early 1980s because they were loss-making. However, they had an enormous public relations problem on their hands because they had thousands of women who by that time had become so institutionalized that had they opened the doors, then these women would have stepped outside and not known how to use a telephone or get a job or find an apartment or anything that we kind of take for granted. So with that in mind, they gradually sort of phased out the Magdalens throughout the 80s and the early 1990s. Because I think, to be fair, a little bit to the church at this point, was there was an element of compassion there because they'd realised what they created. So they became more, if you like nursing homes. But by 1985, they were still taking in young girls and taking their babies from them. So they were still active in that regard. One of the members, our members of cast who's in the film, she had her baby taken from her when she was 15 in 1985. The difference then was she did get out through the front door forcibly and then forcibly went and found the information as to where her baby was and went to Dublin and got her baby back and brought her baby up. And she did threaten them with going to lawyers and to the newspapers and that kind of thing. So that's why they handed over the information. So the church, by 1996, when they finally managed to close the last one, they had also conveniently kept so many of these women behind closed doors so they couldn't speak. But I think it is fair to say there was an element, and I stress only an element, of compassion at that point. However, by that time in Ireland, the growing numbers of people coming forward to talk about abuse by the clergy was already beginning to happen. And by 1997, those floodgates were starting to open, because the more and more people that came forward, the more the church's stance, which was always that they were lying, they were making all this up, with more and more people coming forward talking about different cases of abuse, be it by priests or by nuns, then it became apparent to all and sundry that not people simply couldn't all be lying in these kind of numbers, you know, and that's when attention was paid.
Now that your film is out, what kind of reaction has the church had to it?
Initially, it's been bizarre. Initially, when we opened in Venice, the church came out with outright condemnation, and they took out a now famous headline where three times they said I was a liar. It just said liar, 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 is Mullen. Which was a pretty dumb thing to do, because immediately the Italian press then flew over to London, where they interviewed eight women who had survived the Magdalens and had neither seen the film nor had ever met me. And to be honest, the women's stories were horrific and makes the film look more like Toy Story 2. So the church, by the time we got to... We opened in Ireland after we'd opened in Italy, where we went straight to number one there for about 10, 12 weeks. By the time we opened in Ireland, I was really surprised because the church said nothing. I mean, the silence was deafening. Then, again, the same thing happened in Ireland, and it was a huge popular success. And this February of this year, we opened in Scotland and in England, and the head of the Roman Catholic Church in Scotland, his spokesman on his behalf, took out a half-page review of the film in Scotland's largest newspaper and recommended that every Catholic in the country go and see the film. So the Vatican's position, the Church's position, has completely shifted. As to why that is, I'm not sure. All I really care about is that the various press statements that they've made, the apology that was given to me by the Sisters of Mercy of Americas, if those apologies and the press statements are then, if that translates into action, then I don't really care what the motivation is behind it. Because the principal action that the women are looking for, and especially the babies of the women who are taken from them, what they want more than anything is information. So really, until the church opens its doors and stops this regime of secrecy, until it opens its doors to those for whom it is relevant, then really press statements and apologies, public apologies, are of no use whatsoever.
There's a kind of strange story about your family, that financially your father, he didn't make a lot of money, but you lived in a very grand house in a pretty strongly middle-class neighborhood in Glasgow. It was something of a manor house, which you rented, but you were told never to tell your friends that it was rented, to give off as if you owned this house, to give on. What was that all about?
That was that age-old, sad, working class, you know, we're moving up in the world, don't tell anybody otherwise. It was a doctor's house we lived in, and it was terribly grand, not so now, but it was terribly grand then, especially to us as kids. And we had no furniture. We had no furniture inside. We had no TV, we had no refrigerator, we had no heating, we had nothing. But because my father was respectable working class, he eventually worked at Glasgow University as a lab technician, and he specialised on the laser beam. And with he had ideas, if you like, of middle class kind of respectability. So he liked the outward showing of that, even though inside, I'm afraid, it was something completely different.
It sounds as if your father never really fully recovered from the war. He was abusive. What form did his abuse or did his anger take?
He was emotionally very, very distant. He was very physically violent to my mother until we were able to stop that, which we duly did as soon as we were old enough.
You and your brothers?
Yeah. I mean, as soon as we were big enough, that ceased to be, because we made damn certain that you wouldn't do that. But we grew up, unfortunately, having to witness various ongoing physical and emotional violence and darkness, basically. I mean, to be charitable, which I really am as regards him, I reckon he was substantially damaged during the war. They were a generation of men who didn't come back to any kind of therapy or counselling. And they certainly didn't come back to any kind of economic progress. But he was a man who had eight kids and didn't want eight kids, quite simply. And he didn't know how to deal with it. He didn't know how to deal with us. And he certainly didn't know how to deal with my mother. And so for the first 17 years of my life, the only thing I ever knew about was hatred and darkness. Is my abiding memory. And fortunately, he died the day I started university, which was very nice, because suddenly it was quite literally the sun came in through the living room window. He died as I was ironing my shirt to go to university. He was on the couch is when he died. He had cancer.
Before you went to university, you had kind of a rough time in high school, and you joined a Glasgow gang. What kind of gang was that? Is that along the Clockwork Orange model?
Yeah. We used to try and dress up like them, except we couldn't afford the bowler hats and stuff. But we had the umbrellas, and we had the jock straps, and the one eyelash, and the whole thing, which was weird, because most of us hadn't actually seen the film. We were a bit too young. And it was a teenage thing. You were just desperate to be different and to take on authority and all that. And the most obvious way of doing that in Glasgow at that time, and sadly it remains the case to this day, is you joined a gang and you fought with other gangs. And I did it for a year. I was 14. And I left school, which was horrendous for my mother, because up until then I'd been the clever one that won all the prizes and did all the right things. And then suddenly this window opened. And it was a window of exoticism and violence and fighting and women and drinking and song and cigarettes and all that craziness. And at the time, it seemed like the greatest place on earth. In retrospect, it was a very obvious reaction to what was happening at home. In retrospect. But it doesn't feel that way at the time. At the time, it feels the most natural thing in the world.
So why only a year? How'd you get out of that?
The gang got rid of me. They decided that I was, because I was really losing it. I was wanting to up the ante and to do more daring kind of things, like really taking on the police force and all this kind of stuff. And they decided that I was just a nut, and they were absolutely correct. And thankfully, they said, no, you're just too crazy for us. And so I went back to school and started studying again and just slowly but surely kind of worked it out my system.
How did you get into acting?
I did a school pantomime. You don't know pantomime over here. It's a Christmas show where there's comedy, slapstick, music. And there was a really nice, good-looking group of majorettes, or cheerleaders, as you guys might call them. So, yeah, it was sexually driven, I guess. It was a good way to meet the babes. And that then sort of worked its way when I was at university. I was a very, very serious student of economic, social history and English literature. So, I did drama in my second year and got to meet lots of girls and like-minded kind of guys and stuff, bohemians. And I've stuck with that one ever since, really. But I think in my final year at university, I had a complete nervous breakdown, just completely disintegrated. And to my amazement, a year later, they asked me, by that time I was teaching at university, and they asked me to perform in a play because their actor had dropped out. And in this play, this guy had a complete nervous breakdown. And so I happened to be able to do it on stage, and people applauded and even wrote things in the papers about it and stuff.
What was the catalyst for your breakdown?
To this day, I don't know. I was working about 16 hours a day for about 3 weeks as the final exams approached. And before the final exams, I had been given a lot of prizes at university for coming top of the class and all that kind of nonsense. And I don't know, something happened when I just decided that I was really stupid and I wasn't up for this task. And I put the most ridiculous kind of pressure on myself and then just couldn't take it. Just absolutely just disintegrated. I was word blind for about 9 months. I couldn't read a road sign. It was just meltdown, I guess. So it was the worst and best thing that ever happened to me. Because had I got what I'd been looking for, then I would have become an academic. And I would have gotten my PhD, and I would have gotten my professorship, and I would have been a very unhappy academic. So it was the best and worst.
What did you do for those 9 months then that you couldn't read and you couldn't...
Don't know. Wandered about in a daze most of the time, trying to pick up what I thought was left of what little reputation I may have had. But within that 9 months, I started to do plays. I acted in some plays, and I found acting very therapeutic because I could be as vulnerable or as invulnerable as I wanted on a stage, in the sense that I was willing to expose any of the inner workings to an audience as a means of trying to understand it myself. And like I say, I probably still do that to this day.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Peter Mullen wrote and directed The Magdalene Sisters.